Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with bonkers.ie, Ireland's favourite comparison and switching website. Visit bonkers.ie today and start saving on your household bills.
1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. 51551 is our text number. Laura, good afternoon. We're continuing because of the overwhelming number of calls and stories, unfortunately, that are emerging about people who, young people especially, with serious mental health issues. Laura, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe. How's it going?
It's your daughter. What age is she?
She's 13.
And why did you have to call the Gardaí recently?
We just had, basically, there was a lot of issues kind of leading up to that point. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we had been seeing CAMHS and had been explaining how things were becoming more and more out of control. Okay. Erratic, unpredictable behaviour. She had told them that her meds weren't working. But like everything, you know, all they were saying was that these things take time.
And what were the child, the mental health services, CAMHS, what were they prescribing?
At the time, she was on risperidone, and back in May, she had started to self-harm. And after ringing every single day for weeks, I finally got an emergency appointment. Mm-hmm. And the psychologist at that point said that apparently self-harming is normal teenage behaviour. She basically increased her meds and sent us on our way. So when things kind of were getting further out of control, she had, you know, stopped eating. She was getting dizzy. The self-harming was still happening. We went back to CAMHS, and at that point, we had been transferred from one team to a new team based on location and them changing, okay, you know, with air codes and stuff. So the new team then obviously had to, they were literally starting from scratch. So it was a case of going in, having meetings, and for them to build up a picture. Now, from the first time we've seen them till now, they have seen her four times. So that's 4 one-hour sessions they've had. And when, as I said, when we ended up calling the guard, and, you know, things escalated and May became a little bit uncontrollable. So we ended up being taken to the Garda station. She was still uncontrollable while we were there.
But she was uncontrollable when the Garda arrived?
Yes.
And was she uncontrollable for the Garda? Do you follow me?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, yeah. Sure, okay. Yeah. So, as I said, she was cuffed and she was in the back of a Garda van. And so I drove behind the van then, and it took another good half hour before she calmed down at the Garda station, before they could take the cuffs off, which even at that was just horrendous to see, to watch.
And how was she interacting with the Gardaí that they had to put handcuffs on?
Screaming, shouting, kicking, you know, verbally abusing them. Absolutely, completely hysterical, totally out of control.
So you agreed with the Gardaí handcuffing her?
Oh, absolutely. Okay, look, they were very understanding, very considerate. You know, it hadn't been the first time that they had been called. They had remembered being here at different times over the years.
What age? She's 13.
Yeah.
She's handcuffed. The Gardaí and you, the family, agree that she had to be handcuffed, probably for her own safety.
Absolutely, yeah.
At 13, what age was she when this behaviour started showing itself?
Well, it was always there, Joe, to be honest with you. And when a child, you know, especially when it's your first child and you've no experience of what to expect and what to, you know, what's going to come along. And you put it down, you put it down to terrible twos, and then, you know, her brother being born, and then a new childminder coming on board, and then starting school. And so by the time she was six, we had kind of, at that point, thought there's something not right here. You know, we've just had, you know, she was still having, like, the 2-hour tantrums, like, if she didn't get her way, which obviously she, you know, wouldn't always get her way. So at that point, we started to look into, you know, getting some help then. Mm. So we had an assessment of needs done at that point. And while they said she did show signs of severe behavioural issues, that they didn't think there was any concerns, and they didn't feel the need to offer any services or mm-hmm. pursue issues further.
And I know she's only 13, but has anybody, and I don't know if this in itself is helpful, but just for guidance, has anyone put a name on what's happening? Or
well, when she was 9 then, we went privately, and they did give her a diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder and ADHD. Mm. Now, and again, at that point then, it took us, so that was 9, it took us about 2 years before CAMHS would see us, and it wasn't that there was long waiting lists, they just refused to see us. Her psychologist sent in a report, the 6 to 18 disability sent in a referral, mm-hmm. her GP sent a referral, the counsellor we were seeing at the time sent a referral, the school sent a referral. That was 5 different professional bodies that had sent letters to CAMHS, and at every single point they just sent back a letter saying, we reviewed this case and we won't see your child. Now, they never gave me any explanation. When I would ring, they'd say, oh, we can't speak to you because you're not a patient. And I was like, well, that's the whole point. Like, we want to be a patient
yeah.
you know. So someone had told me at that point that if you send them a letter by post, that, you know, they're obliged to reply. So I have a folder upstairs as long as your arm with the correspondence between myself and CAMHS. And every time they would just reply, I'd outline all the issues that we were having, the impact it was having on the rest of the family, and just please, please, please help us.
And how did the incident where we're now on the Garda station and your daughter's in handcuffs, 13 years of age, how did that play out?
Well, they, as I said, they were very sympathetic to our situation. And when we were in the Garda station, they said she was very distressed, even when, you know, they had kind of taken the cuffs off, that they got a doctor in to review her in the Garda station. The doctor advised us to go to the hospital to get her checked out, which we did. And they kind of gave us a quiet little area in A&E so that she could sleep. Now, at this point, it was like 2 o'clock in the morning, and they had given me a Garda escort to the hospital just to ensure that we got there safely without any further issues. So the following morning, they admitted her to the hospital. So this was, say, Wednesday the 16th of October, they admitted her. Because we were due to have a CAMHS appointment that morning anyway, but she had refused point blank that she wasn't going.
Mm-hmm.
So the hospital contacted CAMHS for them to come to the hospital instead, which they did. And at that point then, they decided to try new meds and keep her in hospital to monitor her with the new meds and see how things progressed. Now, I know, like, in a lot of cases, it can take time for new medication to work and to kick in. But again, straight away, she didn't feel any different. And because she was being monitored in the hospital, they were able to increase it every day rather than kind of over a number of weeks.
Okay, so where are we now, Laura?
So where we are now, so basically, and again, the hospital staff are fantastic, but it's a paediatric unit. They're not equipped and they're not trained to deal with any kind of mental health issues. CAMHS pretty much washed their hands of us, to be honest. They're saying that this is not a mental health issue. So the fact that my child is covered in scars from where she's cut herself, the fact that she's lost, you know, probably the best part of 3 dress sizes with starving herself, they're saying that there's no mental health issue there. So they're saying they only deal with ADHD, so they're passing the ASD part of it back to the disability team. So my point back to them was that you can't take different parts of a child's mind and get different psychologists mm-hmm. from different teams to look at that don't have any communication. There's no links between the disability team and CAMHS.
And
it just doesn't work. So basically, we were in the hospital for 16 days. Now, May did try to leave on a number of occasions, and security had to be called. So it led to a situation where there were four, maybe five security guards holding her down while a doctor sedated her. So that happened probably five times in the 16 days we were there. There was no counselling, there was no therapy, there was no coping skills. It was just her in a room, obviously with me and my husband taking turns to be with her. They assigned a 24-hour security guard and a 24-hour nurse. So we were basically like living in a fishbowl, being watched constantly while we were trying to see what would happen. As I said, CAMHS, you know, just wanted to offer an outpatient appointment, you know, and for my, you know, concerns to them was like, that's 1 hour a week. What happened to the other 167 hours when we're at home with these, like, kind of sometimes violent outbursts, and how am I supposed to manage that if it's taken four security guards to cope with it in the hospital? So we had tried to get a place in St. John of God's. We had tried to get a place in Pat's, and for different reasons, they came back and said no. Okay. Now, at the same time...
And where are we today, Laura?
So where are we today? We're at home. Okay. Basically, May, while she wanted to come home, she didn't want to come home without anything, and in her own words, without anything changing, because she was afraid of what she would do if she had one of these kind of outbursts. Now, again, the medication had to be changed while we were still in the hospital. Mm. So she's on a completely different mix of meds at the moment. As I said, we came home on Thursday completely deflated. I personally felt that I had let my child down, even though I believe, you know, and we've fallen through the cracks in the system, and that there is nothing available for, you know, these teenagers that are in trouble. And she, when she was having moments of being calm and considering things that happened, she was begging me not to take her home because she wanted help. She wanted someone to teach her how to cope, you know, how to notice the signs of when she was feeling, you know, this kind of aggression or these kind of overwhelming feelings. And there's just nothing or nobody there to say, hey, you know, here's what we can offer you, you know.
Okay.
And now, so we left the hospital on Thursday. This is now Monday. And CAM still haven't been in touch to discuss their care plan, which is, you know, what they were sending us home with. I have phoned them numerous occasions and just can't get anybody, like.
Okay, stay with us, Laura, and just remind people, by the way, the Samaritan's number is 116123, and our text number is 51551, but to remind people that, okay, we're doing stories as they come in. There's not necessarily any connection to be drawn from one story to another. Aveen, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
And this, the person you want to talk about in the mental health services is your late brother.
Yeah, my brother Enda.
Okay, and tell us his experience and the family's experience of trying to get help.
Well, Enda suffered from his mental health issues from the age of 17. He was diagnosed with bipolar.
Okay.
Had been in and out of treatment on different medication, but he was finally flying the summer before he died, and he was working home here on the family farm. Just one night then, he went into my mother and said to her, my head's melted, need to get some help, and he rang himself an ambulance, and that was the first time that he'd taken it upon himself, really, because Enda would either have really highs or really lows, and we'd kind of be, okay, come on, you need to go in and get some help or whatever, but this was the first time where he'd made the move himself, and to us, that was a major step forward.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was a Thursday night, so he went into A&E on the Thursday night.
Mm-hmm.
To a hospital that he hadn't been to for mental health, because the unit that he'd normally go to had unfortunately been closed. And he was left waiting to see a psychiatrist, and 9 hours later, he got seen and he got sent home with an outpatient's appointment for his own psych team on the Wednesday, and some tablets to help him sleep. His appointment was on the Wednesday, and unfortunately, he committed suicide on the Tuesday. And obviously, Joe, we're all left devastated by it. You know, and like, it was, he was in A&E, you know, his own GP was brilliant and that, but I think when he needed the help, it was out of hours, and he rang himself an ambulance and went to A&E to try and get the help that he needed.
And had he ever taken a step of phoning an ambulance for himself before?
Yes, he had taken that step, and as I said to a researcher, and before when they rang me, normally with Enda, you would have had to kind of be, okay, come on, we need to maybe go in and have a look at your meds and see, can we change them or can we help you or whatever. And so he'd normally be, we'd be the ones bringing him in or whatever. And of course, you know, he had to want to go himself.
Yeah, and this is him saying, if you dial 999 and look for an ambulance for yourself, this is you saying two things. One, I am unwell. And two, I am so unwell, I need an ambulance to take me to a hospital.
And sorry, Joe, for interrupting, but for him to do that himself was a major step, because we'd normally be, you know, talking him to go, come on, we'd bring you in, we'd get to the doctor or whatever, and we'd have to do that. And he'd have to then be talked around to sign himself or, you know, to go in and to get the help or whatever, because unfortunately, that's the way it would have to be, even though families know somebody when they have a mental health. If you're living with somebody with a mental health issue, like that woman, who, you know, she knew her daughter wasn't well, the family members of the people know that they're not well, and unfortunately, if we were to bring him in, we can't. He has to want to be there himself.
And was there ever a name?
Unless they're under eight, unless they're like under eight, he'd have to, like, you know, we could tell if he was getting high or getting low. Well, not all the time, but sometimes you could. Do you know that kind of way?
And high and low, that means he was suffering from bipolar depression. Okay. So when he arrived in the hospital, what was the sequence of events then? I know you've outlined them in general. Like, he arrived at the hospital, the ambulance, the paramedics would have said, this man has presented, has called himself. He said his, I don't know what language he used, but he told his mother that his head was melting, it was melted, and he wants help. Do you know what the sequence of events were then? Did they put him in a bed? Did they put him in a ward? Did they?
Well, he was left sitting on a chair. Me and my mother went up with him. He was left sitting on a chair for a couple of hours. And I had gone to the doctor and had obviously said, you know, somebody needs to talk to him. And they had called the person, but they were busy or whatever. He was left on a chair for a little while. And then they had obviously rang to see if they had a bed in the psych department, and they didn't. And they'd rang another hospital to see if they had a bed. And fortunately, they didn't either. But eventually he got a bed, and they gave him something to help him sleep, because he'd been having trouble sleeping. Yeah. So they gave him something to help him sleep, and he was on a bed. And after being in the hospital in A&E nine hours or so, I got a phone call from the psychiatrist to ask me why he'd been there, and I told him the story. And and then obviously Enda told him what he was feeling, and it kind of went from there. And as I said, then they gave him some tablets to help him sleep, and they made an outpatient appointment with his own psych team.
But they sent him home.
That was the Wednesday. But as I was saying, you know, that's a long time between a Friday and a Tuesday.
Yeah.
You know, but unfortunately, that's just the way the system is. And I think, you know, he looked for the help, and obviously it just didn't come quick enough for him, unfortunately.
He was presenting himself, which is
a brave thing to
some
do as
statement.
Well.
Yeah. And the following Tuesday, he died by suicide.
Yeah.
And then the effect on the family. I can't, he's a very young man, 32.
Yeah. Joe, it was devastating for everybody, to be honest. You don't expect it.
Yeah.
Especially, I suppose, when he was in the hospital and he had taken that step, we had thought that maybe, okay, he'll get the help he needs now and he'll be on the road and it'll be grand. But it happens, and then it was totally devastating to everybody, for and even the local community as well. Like, you know, he was involved with, you know, he had loads of friends, lots of friends in the community, and you know, he was only 32 when he died, so he was quite young, like
very young.
And it was devastating for the family, but it was devastating. Like, it was devastating for us all. We really, like, I was in work, you know, all my brothers were here at work, you know, everyone was, you know, and you got, you know, I remember myself, my husband came up to work and told me, and I, like, just devastating for everybody and for my parents in particular as well. You know, losing, you know, as a parent, I don't think you ever think you should lose a child, and that was obviously, you know, devastating for them. And I suppose we were just very, very lucky that our community were amazing to us. Yeah. They really rallied behind us, and, you know, just, it was, you know, the outpouring of love from the community was amazing.
And Eivin, did you have any subsequent communication from the mental health services?
No.
Nothing?
The family?
Yes.
No. We've had, obviously, Pieta House have, you know, came out, their counsellors or whatever like that. They have bereavement, which was the side of things I never knew Pieta House did, was the whole thing of they have a team that helps bereaved families due to suicide. They came out, but I haven't, you know, haven't heard anything from them.
And the in terms of a name, it was bipolar disorder. Was, from what age did they, was he diagnosed?
17.
17, okay.
Yeah, 17 was the first signs of it.
But that was that his first
and
time
then
in
it just, yes, from 17, and then he died at 32, and it was just after his 32nd birthday. His birthday was the 18th of August.
And was that his first time? Was that his first time in A&E?
For mental health issues?
Yeah.
No.
Ah, okay.
No, he'd been in to his own, to our local A&E, where there was a unit, and unfortunately they closed the unit and moved it somewhere else. So that's, you know, that's the side of things that probably needs to be looked at as well. You know, there was a unit close to us where we live, and unfortunately it got closed and got moved further away with less beds. So I don't know, you know, if that unit was open, would it be different? I don't know.
Yeah,
but
it's all the what ifs, it's all the what ifs.
Yeah, and there's a lot of why questions. And
yeah.
But I suppose the one thing that our family have said from end of story is that if it could help one other person, that's what we want. We want to let people who might be thinking about it that there is options.
Yeah.
And you know, you do have, you might not want to talk to your doctor or your family member, but talk to somebody. You know there's lots of different phone lines and lots of different places that you can go and talk to somebody. And I know it's hard to say that, but just please, like, remember that there is somebody there that you can talk to, that you're not alone. And it is hard. And I suppose for families of people who are suffering with mental health, you know, just, you know, don't be too hard on yourself as a family either, do you know?
Absolutely.
It's hard to deal with it, you know, but...
Okay, Eivin, stay with us if you would, please. 51551 and joe@rte.ie. Back after this.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
And joe@rte.ie. Laura's daughter, we opened the programme with, her call, is 13 years of age and recently had to be restrained by Gardaí, including handcuffed, because she was so disruptive, and eventually taken to a hospital with a Garda escort. Patricia, what age is your daughter?
She's 9.
Okay, and what is she showing in terms of
mental health? I was on to you, I think about a year ago or so, when she, just before her 4th birthday, she was diagnosed with autism. And then, so as I said, she's 9 now. So when she was 8, we had, she was increasingly, anxiety was a huge issue with her, and she was showing that by becoming very self-harming, banging her, now she's a bit younger maybe than Laura's daughter there, she was banging her head on the walls, putting holes in the walls in the house, and then lashing out at us and hitting out at us, and attacking us in the car, well, me especially in the car. It was becoming particularly dangerous, etc. So I strongly suspected, I knew it was all anxiety based, and I strongly suspected ADHD, because I've another family member with ADHD, and I went to, I said to the network disability team, who she's been under since she was diagnosed with autism. That's essentially the HSC that provides services like speech therapy and occupational therapy and that. And they said they wouldn't assess her or do anything about that. She needed to go to CAMHS, so I went to my GP, got a referral to CAMHS. CAMHS got a letter then from CAMHS saying they wouldn't see her because she needs to be treated by the network disability team. So I rang them up and I said, she's already under them. They said to go to you. And they said, well, because she has autism, we can't see her. And I said, well, you're discriminating against her because of her disability. I don't want her to be treated for her autism. I want her to be treated for her anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And they said, well, no, we won't see her because she has autism. And I repeated, you're discriminating against her. And they said, well, I wouldn't put it like that. And I said, well, how would you put it? And what are you going to do when there's some serious harm comes to my daughter or to me or to somebody else whenever we're traveling, you know, because I had some very hairy situations, especially in the car. And I was then accused of getting very aggressive. And that was that. And that's the end of the conversation. And I then went privately to a child psychiatrist. And I got her assessed and diagnosis of ADHD, put on medication, which has made a world of difference. And the psychiatrist was totally sympathetic with my situation. She doesn't work privately, publicly anymore, and said, this is suboptimal care, but I understand where you're coming from and I will treat your daughter. But really the most optimal care, mm-hmm. best care would be for her to be under the treatment of CAMHS. And I said, well, this is where we are. And she said, I know. Since she's gone on the medication and we've done put other stuff in place, her anxiety is reduced hugely and we've a different child now. I know, I'm not saying she is challenging at times and we have moments and all of that, but it's, you know, yeah.
And what made a difference? Was it the
medication and excuse me, and just putting sort of behavioural structures in place that, you know, I kind of looked into when I got the diagnosis of what the best things is to do, etc. And working with her school, she's in a fabulous school now as well.
Okay, so brilliant. You got a diagnosis privately.
Yeah. And I have spent about €2,000 in total on that. And I was just very lucky because I didn't have that.
What difference did a diagnosis of ADHD make?
It made a huge difference because we knew what was going on with her. We could research it. We could look what was going on with her as well as the autism. Like the two, and it's very common for, it's a very, the two conditions are very commonly go together with children. It just so we knew what was going on, we knew where we're, you know, and even getting the medication as well.
And Annie, Patricia, it sounds now that you have hope.
Oh, yeah.
That's wonderful.
But there
were times when you were at your wit's end, I suspect, given
I couldn't bring her out. We were terrified to bring her out because we were, you know, she could just run up and hit someone else, hit another child. It was just, and people were very understanding, but at the same time, you know, and I was terrified of one particular case. She attacked me in the car on a main motorway. Terrifying. And you could just see, you know, it was terrifying to see, and it's heartbreaking to see her in that state.
Yeah.
You know?
I'm just trying to offer Laura some hope about her 13-year-old. I know your daughter. Yeah.
But my issue is, it's heartbreaking listening. I mean, God, it's heartbreaking for her. But, you know, CAMHS, just, I can't understand why they can't, why they get away with not seeing children with a disability.
This is it, Anna. It's very easy to say, it's very easy to say, that's for the other team to look after. This is not a mental health issue. But if you have, as I said, a 13-year-old child, because she is a child, begging for help, cutting herself, starving herself, you know, asking these people who, you know, you're told to go to for help. Mm-hmm. And they're saying, no, 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 you don't have any issues. Now, just ironically enough, you were saying there, you went privately. I had brought Aaron to see a paediatrician over a number of issues back in September. And then, obviously, the self-harming was one of the things we brought up. And she referred us to an adolescent psychiatrist. So when we got back from the hospital on Thursday, feeling as deflated and as broken as we were, there was a letter from one of these psychologists with a consent form to fill out and send back. Now, they're breaking the assessment down. So there's three parts of it. And basically, if I want to go ahead with this, then I need to pay €1,200 up front for them to do this assessment. And then it's €200 per hour after that for any kind of treatment. So, and it also says, like, obviously this has to be paid up front, and, you know, you may be able to claim some of this back through your insurance. But, like, and don't get me wrong, I will absolutely remortgage my house if it meant my daughter receiving the care she needed. But, you know, it's obscene. Like, you're talking that's going to be the best part of €2,000, you know, before they even give her any treatment. And, you know, while the new medication she's on does seem to be helping, the medication is only one small part of it. You know, nothing is going to change if they don't teach her new coping skills, if they don't teach her how to spot the signs, you
to
know, and all
herself,
of this stuff.
Emotional regulation.
Absolutely, it's a huge part of it. Now, one of the points I wanted to make, and for me it's huge, especially when you're looking at costs. So my daughter was in the hospital, we were there 16 nights, and I'd say for 12 of those nights, she had 24-hour security and a 24-hour nurse. Now, just for pure calculation point of view, if those people were on minimum wage, you're talking 980 by 2 by 24. So for 7 days, that's a cost of €3,200. And nothing happened. Nobody helped her. Now, surely that type of money would treat somebody, would get them the help they require, rather than just wasting time, resources, everything on something that's not...
There doesn't seem to be any joined-up thinking in the HSC.
No, there's not. Like,
it all essentially comes under the HSC, the disability team, CAMHS, et cetera, et cetera, inpatient hospital stay. You know, there's no joined-up thinking, as far as I can, in my experience, and from what you're saying as well. So,
And that's the whole problem, is that people are just falling through the gaps, because it's very easy. I mean, even, obviously, with all of this stuff that's going on, TUSLA have been involved as well, and various referrals. It seems to be the norm that everybody can get off on a technicality. I mean, TUSLA were like, oh, well, this is not really our issue, because... You know, technically we're a child protection agency, and technically your child is not at risk. And I'm like, well, technically she is, because she's 13, she's vulnerable, she's, you know, in the lead up to, you know, some of the things that happened before we ended up in the hospital, she was going missing, she was hanging around with people that we didn't know, with groups of boys, you know, anything could have happened. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, she was a child at risk, because she still is a child at risk, you know. But technically, you know, it's not their area. And then technically, it's not CAMHS' area. You know, so everybody is getting off on a technicality. And unfortunately, the only people that are suffering here are the people that need the help, you know.
And your family.
And my family, like, I mean, this has had a huge impact on us. Like, I, you know, have a 10-year-old son as well. And, you know, he's struggling big time. Like, and he's normally so laid back and calm. And he's struggling big time. Myself and my husband were, like, shifts in the night, you know, up and down to the hospital, you know, so that she wasn't on her own. And I have to say, we have a fantastic support network with extended family, my sisters, my mother. You know, and without them, I'd probably be on a psych ward as well, because it's just, you need somebody to lean on. You need somebody to run to and to pick you back up when you hit rock bottom, because it's so hard, so hard.
My since my daughter was diagnosed with the autism and the limited services we got from the disability team and have been getting, it's been, you know, a lot of it is, you know, you have to look after yourself, self-care and all this. I've gone,
yeah.
I have to take deep breaths and I'm going, yeah, where do I find the time for that?
Exactly, because it's a full-time job.
Yeah.
And then, like, sure, one of the social worker in the hospital the other day, you know, said to me, oh, like, I haven't been in work in 3 weeks. And mm-hmm. she said to me, oh, maybe you need to take some time out and be at home all the time, you know, so you're there. And I'm like, there's nothing more in the world I would like to do. But then what happens? Then I don't pay my mortgage. Then my house is repossessed. And then what? You know, that every action has a consequence and a reaction. And yes, absolutely, my daughter is the number one priority in my life. But we still need to live somewhere too, you know?
Yeah, I'm just, I don't know whether any of you, it's, and again, I'm not, there's no sequence in the calls today, and there's no sequence either in the news, but the story breaking is about that a young man who was 15 at the time, who attempted to, he told his mother he needed help and psychiatric help and was hearing voices, and he went out and he went out and savagely attacked. It was on Christmas Eve. 2017, and he savagely attacked this woman who miraculously survived, but he's been sentenced to 11 years in prison. But the story, I'm reading Conor Gallagher's a powerful piece in the Irish Times, a long piece. It's well worth a read. Now, I don't want either of you to read it, because I don't think there's any sequence, but just it's another aspect of the mental health services where people seem to go for help, and it's only when, because one of the things that Conor Gallagher reveals in this piece is when one of the senior medics after this crime, he interviewed their son. He prescribed a different medication, and that worked wonders on him. And I think the mother says it was as if the badness had gone out of him. Anyway, stay with us. 51551 Joe at rt.ie.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
One of the things that I've been hearing over the weekend about the especially Friday's programme, the powerful testimony from so many parents and siblings about their relations who've been and have experienced mental health difficulties, that there are so many good, and they're all good, so many good charities that deal with these issues. And each of them deal in many ways with a different aspect, which is fantastic. So no criticism there of there being so many different voluntary organisations and charities. But it would be interesting to have them all on one website where people could go in and move around and see what aspect of this situation, because people find themselves in different places at different times when it comes to mental health issues. Now, John is on the line. 51551 is the text number. John makes the point that your son, who died by suicide, died a year before, for example, Pieta House opened.
That's true, Joe.
Yeah. And had he been attending anywhere, John?
Yes, he was attending an agency called Teen Counselling.
Okay.
Took us 7 weeks to get him into it, and they were doing their job.
Okay.
But he obviously needed probably a little bit more. He was, you know, he was being seen once a week, and mm-hmm. unfortunately, then this was during his leaving cert. His therapist had to go on holidays, which is very understandable. It was booked, and she was worried about going on holidays, and she had spoken with him about what to do if he wasn't feeling good. And she'd done her last session with him was in between the morning exam and the afternoon exam, and she felt he wasn't too bad. And he was okay for a few weeks, and it was just a struggle where you were walking on eggshells, Joe.
Right, yeah. And did he, again, as I'm just thinking of milestones and indicate, did he finish his Leaving Cert exams?
He did.
Yeah.
He done Leaving Cert deployed and came second highest in the school.
Wow.
His good friend came 2 points or 2% higher than him, and then he felt guilty that Sean was dead, and he was after getting 2% higher than him.
Oh.
Crazy. But crazy. They're just some of the ripple effects that suicide leave behind you.
And don't tell us how he died, but the his interaction with the mental health services, generally, was he in touch, or was the family in contact with CAMHS, the child and adult, adolescent mental health services?
No, this was in 2005, Joe, where he had tried to take his life on April the 23rd,
mm-hmm.
where he took household tablets, and he survived taking them. And went down to the chemist just to see what was in them. And the guy in the chemist knew me, and he just, Jesus, John, I'm sorry, commiserations. And I goes, no, sitting down in the car. He goes, it couldn't be. But luckily enough, he was. And mm-hmm. then we tried to get him into counselling. We went up to our own doctor. Our own doctor was absolutely brilliant. And he was okay for a few weeks. But it was I honestly believe it was the 7 weeks waiting list to try and get him in somewhere, because like that was it on April. That was near the end of April, and he was dead. He was dead in June, or sorry, dead in July. Joe, sorry, his birthday was in June.
Yeah.
But there was no CAMHS, or trying to get somebody into the HSE was extremely difficult. Like in between April and in between the time he took the overdose and the time he died. We had him in Blanchardstown on the 17th of June, and he went in an ambulance. I went with him, and he was taken in behind the doctors on his own, and then let back out to me. Now, Blanchardstown's a huge hospital, and the avenues are quite dark, and if you're not feeling good, it can be quite depressing in the winter time or in the summertime, depending on how you are. We went back in, and then the doctor spoke with him and said to me, you know, he's very deep. And I goes, yes, I do understand that. And he goes, right, we're going to send a letter to Clondalkin Mental Health and to your own doctor. And I says, right, that's brilliant. And there's still no letter ever arrived, Joe. But the doctor wanted to send him to somewhere else that dealt with addiction. Now, I know he had no addiction, because after he took the overdose of household tablets for our peace of mind, I done a urine test on him every week just to see if his urine was clean. And he'd say to me every week, he goes, Dad, you know I don't like drugs. And I goes, I do. This is just to try and help us to make sure you're okay.
Right.
But trying to get somebody into the hospital, like he was released out of Blanchardstown Hospital that day, that night, 3:30 in the morning. And just told to go home, and to go on home and have a sleep. You'd be better in the morning. Christ. How can you tell somebody to go home and have a sleep? You'd be better in the morning. After them sitting with a psychiatric doctor and telling the doctor, I want to kill myself. I don't want to be here anymore.
Sounds like something you say to somebody who had a few drinks. Go home and have a sleep, you'll be better in the morning.
Go home and have... That's exactly... Yeah. Like, Joe, I'm a taxi driver now. Before I was a taxi driver, I was a barman. You used to tell people to go home. Go home, get bite eaten, in the hopes that you'd never see them again.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, not never, but you'd see them the next day.
Better, yeah. Or sobered up, yeah.
But the system... I honestly believe the system is worse now than 14 years ago.
Yeah.
Because if you present yourself to any of the hospitals and tell them that you're suicidal, they'll send, whereas going back 14 years ago, they'll take a little, they would have taken a few notes, or they would have tried to help you. Now they just say, right, okay, do you know what? The services that's there is PA the house. There's the phone number at PA the house. Now, outside of me being a taxi driver, I now help people. Not just mainly in my own community, but it has went further, where they've presented themselves to the hospital, and the hospitals have told them to ring PA the house. PA the house is a fantastic organisation. It does what, you know, they do what it says on the tin. They save lives. But they're supported by the normally people that have had a death in the family or a friend that knows somebody, and their finances is nearly always fundraised. But yet here we have the HSE in accident and emergency saying, do you know what, give PA the house a ring in the morning. We are not a third world society that if you break your finger or your arm, you'll go up to the hospitals and they'll put a plaster, a paras, or a splint or something on you. You present yourself, you will sit in A&E for 13, 14, 15 hours, if you're lucky. They'll take you in and then they'll send you off on your merry way.
Yeah, that seems to be the consistent story we're getting from people.
It's, Joe, I shouldn't say this, but I say it everywhere I go. Dead people can't vote.
Yeah.
And until our government realises that they have to do something about the youth of this community, not my community, when I say community, I mean countrywide. We have to do something for our youth, because if we don't, we're going to keep continuing going to funerals, be them cremations or burials. And until our government do something, it's going to stay the way it is. We have, on average, 520 suicides, deaths every year. That is not counting deaths where you have, in some cases, one vehicle crashes or people going into a river, a canal, a lake where there's no letter and they can just say, well, it was accidental death. Until our government and the HSE is run properly, this is going to stay the exact same way, and there will be other families in the same position as we are, where you don't buy birthday presents and you go down and you look at a headstone.
Yeah. Okay, Lisa, stay there, John. Lisa, good afternoon.
How you doing?
Lisa, what happened in your case?
Yeah.
Okay, the line is bad. I'll take a quick break. We're back to you after this.
Okay.
Go ahead, Lisa. Go ahead, quick break.
Yo, Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
Sorry, Lisa, the line was bad there. Go ahead and tell us what happened.
Hiya, Joe. Can you hear me now?
Yes, go ahead.
Joe, I was driving through a village, I won't say where, with my daughter and her girlfriend. And my daughter, it was the night time, and my daughter happened to notice a woman sitting atop a bridge with her feet to the inside towards the river. And basically, I suppose in a nutshell, I pulled in and just speaking to the lady, but she was kind of unresponsive. She was kind of just staring away. But she had to go to the other world. So she made a go to jump, and myself and my daughter pulled her off the bridge. We got her across into my car, and I asked her, would she come back to my house just for a cup of tea? She was very, very distant, Joe, and wasn't really communicating, but she nodded in agreement. So I brought her home to the house. She wasn't saying much at all. She just repeating that she needed to go from this world to the other world. And eventually I got her boyfriend's number from her, got her to write it down. But she became quite manic in the kitchen then in my house. She was there for about an hour and she was looking for a knife. So my daughter went into the sitting room and rang the guard. And I have to say, the guard came very quickly and treated the girl with such great respect and sensitivity. It was very, very admirable. We had then the fire brigade and the whole lot came. But thankfully, obviously, I've maintained contact. Thankfully, the girl is doing very well. What really bothered me about it, though, Joe, more than anything, was a neighbour of mine the next morning obviously had seen all the flashing lights and the personnel outside and asked me, was everything and everybody okay? So I briefly explained to her what had happened, and what she said to me really, really, you know, perplexed me. She said, what are you thinking of at all, bringing a nut into your house? You know, in such a disrespectful
that, was that,
way.
Was that the language that was actually used, Lisa?
That was the word, oh, you know, bring the nut into it. And I just thought, you know, it's a horrible, horrible word anyway, Joe. And looking at that girl and everybody on your show Friday and today, it's heartbreaking. It really is. I have to commend you for your honesty and for the way you're tackling this. You're letting people say things that, you know, we don't get to say out loud. I think Irish society, we're all great for saying I'm grand when anyone asks us, are we okay? And, you know, a lot of the time we're not grand. And I think people and teenagers, adults alike, need to learn to say, no, I'm not okay, and turn to somebody. It's unfortunate that the system's broken. People who do find the courage, and it takes tremendous courage to stand up and say, I'm not okay and I need help. And brick wall, you know, and I think anyone suffering, I mean, I've suffered anxiety for decades and panic attacks, but I can carry myself through it, you know. But I think that when you turn for help and there's none, where do you go, Joe? You know, everybody needs hope. You know, it's fight to have. And it's lovely to hear stories of success as well in people moving on, you know, in life, on your show.
The stories have a certain trend, as I said, between today and Friday, but also there is hope coming through, and mainly it's coming through. I know the state services are under immense pressure, but it's coming through, as we heard on Friday with Lucy, through her own counselling of her son. They have an incredible relationship. It's coming through through voluntary organisations. It's coming through like people like yourself stepping out of the car and putting on the hazard lights and trying to help someone in difficulty. So let's hope there is hope and indeed help. And I come back to that point I've been making earlier. I said, like, on the one hand, we had a fantastic weekend. Katie Taylor, Rory McIlroy, the hockey team, all the various other sporting achievements that went on that brought so much joy. And on the other hand, there's such underlying, it seems to me, underlying sadness and depression and mental problems there, which need to be addressed. And someone said to me at the weekend, is it much greater than we actually believe? But anyway, thanks for that, Lisa, Laura, John, Patricia and Avian. Back after this, 51551.